Let's start by becoming reacquainted with where we are in this overall process. What is the overall process, first of all? No. That's part of it. The overall process. Well, who else wants to step up then? Yes, it's the complete oxidation of glucose, meaning using that energy to its full, that fuel to its fullest. Okay, there's two parts to that, right? What's part one? Okay, where does that happen? One of you is correct. The cytosol, yes. Glycolysis happens in all cells, even those that don't have mitochondria. Okay, so yes, that's part one, which itself is 10 steps, right? What's part two? Cellular respiration, which occurs where? In a mitochondrion, if it's a eukaryote, exactly. Okay, that's part two of the overall process, cellular respiration is. But cellular respiration itself has three parts, right? What's the first part of cellular respiration? Perfect. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Part two. Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle, any of those three names. Correct. And then part three. Yeah. Oxidative phosphorylation, exactly. Which you can think of as part three of part two, right? Part three, oxidative phosphorylation, itself has two parts. What are those? What's part one of that? Part one of oxidative phosphorylation. Yeah.
Electron transport.
Exactly. Electron transport. Followed by... Go ahead. Chemiosmosis. Correct. Those are the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation. Electron transport and chemiosmosis. Now, we started electron transport last time. We got a little bit through slide 17. Electron transport is a process. It's what's happening. But that process, the transport of electrons, requires structures. The structures shown in cartoon form in this slide are protein complexes making up what are called electron transport chains. So electron transport chains are the structures that allow for electron transport to occur. And you don't see it in this slide, but the protein complexes that make up the chains, because there's many, many copies. This is just one chain. They work individually, but there's a hell of a lot of them. Anyway, the electron transport chains themselves are embedded in membrane. They are membrane-bound protein complexes, but not the plasma membrane. After all, we're talking about a part of cellular respiration, which we've already established happens in a mitochondrion, right? So these electron transport chains in eukaryotes are bound to the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. Keeping in mind that a mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bonded organelle. So it has an outer membrane and an inner membrane. It's the inner membrane in which these protein complexes shown here, making up the chains, are bound. They are part of that inner membrane. Now, I think I was comparing the electron transport chain to a bucket brigade last time. Did I say, was talking about that? Okay. Yes, except that it's not buckets of water, of course. It's electrons that get passed from member to member of the chain. And that's where this figure comes in as a graph. This is actually a graph. Notice the y-axis is g. What it says is that as electron transport occurs, in other words, as electrons get passed from one member of the chain to the next, the electrons are losing energy. They're going down in g value. In other words, energy is being released a little bit at a time. Each step, there's a little bit of a release of energy. And so this is really where earlier figures were comparing organisms to multi-step hydroelectric power plants. Instead of releasing all that energy at once, it's released stepwise, and that really describes the electron transport chain more than anything else. All right, now, the electron transport chain operates by moving electrons from one member to the next. Therefore, just based on that knowledge alone, how would you describe the chemistry that's happening in the electron transport chain? It is biochemical, because that simply means it's chemistry that's happening in an organism. But more specifically, what is happening chemically if electrons are being passed from one member of a chain to the next? Well, yes, because electrons are carrying charge. But how do you describe the chemical process? What do you know about transferring electrons around? Is there anything that you've learned in this course that deals with transfer of electrons?
I know it, but
well, you haven't come up with it yet. Has any of you ever heard of a thing called redox?
Oh, I wasn't going to say that.
That's exactly what we have here, right? Transfers of electrons. As the first member passes an electron to the second member, what's happening to the first member? It's getting oxidized. And what's happening to the second member? Getting reduced. It's not going to stay reduced because it's going to pass it to the third member. So it will become oxidized and the third member will become reduced and so on. It's a series of redox reactions. And each one releases a little bit of energy, which is why this thing is going down in G. All right? Now, there's four major protein complexes making up each electron transport chain, and those are Roman numeral named. 1, 2, 3, and 4. But notice that three of those are especially big. 1, 3, and 4 are bigger than 2. And when we look at a different picture that shows how they're situated in the membrane, you'll see that 1, 3, and 4 are also transmembrane complexes. They stick all the way through the thickness of the membrane. And that's important because these three complexes do double duty. One duty is that they are members of the chain, so they function for electron transport. But they also serve as pumps, which is why they have to be transmembrane, right? A pump has to be transmembrane, otherwise it can't get something through all the way through the membrane. So there's specifically what is happening is that these are things are acting as proton pumps. Now, what is a proton?
It's
It's a hydrogen ion, yes. It's just a different name for it. So proton is a subatomic particle, but a hydrogen ion is a proton. So what are being pumped through just complexes 1, 3, and 4 are protons. And since these are in the inner mitochondrial membrane, that means protons are being pumped through the inner mitochondrial membrane. From one chamber in the mitochondrion to the other. Because remember, since it has two membranes, the mitochondrion has two compartments. The intermembrane space between the outer and the inner membrane, and the mitochondrial matrix, which is all the way inside the inner membrane. And the chain, which is part of that membrane, is on the boundary. Complexes 1, 3, and 4 pump protons from the mitochondrial matrix into the intermembrane space. And we'll get a better picture of that view in a minute. But calling these things pumps is descriptive for what reason? What do we mean by pumps? Exactly. They are active transporters. These protons don't want to move in that direction. That's the opposite of the direction they want to move in. They're going against their gradient. That's why it requires a pump to actively transport them. Any kind of pump, therefore, requires a source of energy to force that to happen. We've looked at pumps, some examples, right? We had sodium-potassium exchange pumps. And we also even had a proton pump in the example that I showed you to explain secondary active transport. That was a proton pump as well, right? But in those examples we already looked at, those pumps were powered how? ATP. Well, think about where we are. We're in a process whose goal is to produce ATP. So why would we have pumps that require ATP in a process that we want to make ATP with? After all, some of the energy is going to be lost as heat, so you couldn't make as much ATP out as you started with in a process. You're going to lose some as heat. So these pumps are not powered by ATP. That would be accomplishing exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do, which is to produce ATP. Still, they're pumps. Every pump has to have an energy source. So to pump these protons, to force them to go from the matrix to the intermembrane space, what is the energy source? Yes, but only indirectly. What is directly powering these pumps? The flow of electrons, the energy that's released by electron transport, right? This G is going down. That's a release of energy. That is what is directly powering these pumps to pump protons through the membrane. So notice that there's two subatomic particles involved here. Electrons are being transported to provide stepwise energy release, and protons are being pumped by using that energy release. What do you have if you have an electron and a proton? A hydrogen atom, which is exactly where these things were originally. We've been stripping, ever since glycolysis, we've been stripping the fuel, which started out as glucose but changed along the way, of hydrogens, which are electrons and protons. Now we're to the point of using that energy that was stored in the form of full taxis, reduced coenzymes, a bunch of NADHs and H pluses, plus, from the citric acid cycle, also some FADH2. They're carrying electrons and protons that are hydrogen atoms that used to be in the fuel. The electrons are going to be delivered to the chains by these taxis. And as those electrons from the fuel get transported down the chains, that release of energy powers the pumps to pump the proton parts of the hydrogens through the membrane. Okay? Does all that make sense so far? All right. Now, as I said last time, once the citric acid cycle is complete, there is no more fuel, and we're already past that point. Citric acid cycle is already done. That's earlier, right? So we have no more fuel left. We've gone through glycolysis. We've gone through the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. We've gone through the citric acid cycle. The fuel is gone. We have made a little bit of ATP via substrate level phosphorylation in the glycolysis and the citric acid cycle. So that ATP is, of course, valuable. That's the goal. But the fuel is gone. So there's nothing else we can get out of the fuel. However, we still had a lot of energy that was originally in the fuel being carried around by reduced coenzymes, the full taxis, right? NADH and FH+ and FADH2. That's before we get to where we are now. So the energy, the fuel's gone, but that's okay because we had the energy of these taxis. Now the taxis are dumping their electrons off to the chains, and as those electrons pass through, that energy is gone. And notice that the electron transport stage here does not produce any ATP. So you not only no longer have any fuel, you also don't have any valuable coenzymes. They're all empty now. Why does this work for the cell? You've made no additional ATP here. But you're going to still be able to make ATP even though you no longer have any valuable taxis carrying the energy that was in the fuel, and you no longer have any fuel. In other words, where now is the energy that's still useful that started out in glucose? It's not in fuel. It's not in reduced coenzymes. Where is it? Where is the usable energy that used to be in the fuel, now that the fuel is gone and now that the taxis are empty? Well, let me ask a different question. It's basically the same thing. What does electron transport directly accomplish? In other words, electron transport isn't just a way to waste that energy, because it does release the energy that was in the taxis. So it must accomplish something. What does it accomplish? What did I tell you it accomplishes? About 10 minutes ago. No. It is redox. It doesn't accomplish redox.
So the chain is inside the inner membrane?
Yeah, it's part of the membrane. But what does electron transport directly accomplish? What did I just tell you it did about 10 minutes ago? It's associated with a release of energy, right? The electron transport releases energy. What does that do?
Positively charged?
No. What did you write down in your notes?
Positively
I told you what it does, what it allows. The release of energy by electron transport powers the pumps. So the answer to what does it accomplish is what? It accomplishes the pumping of protons, right? And what does that itself accomplish? What does the pumping of protons accomplish? Or what does it result in? If you pump protons, what happens? Well, what does it mean to pump protons? No clue as to what it means to pump protons? We were just talking about this as well. What is a pump? Okay, so what it means to pump protons is mean they're actively transported. What does that mean, though? Well, that's true, but what does it mean to actually actively transport them? What is happening? Yes. It's going through the membrane, but what makes it active transport? That's true.
It can't happen naturally.
That's true. Can't happen without an additional expenditure of energy. But what does it result in? If you keep pumping protons, what situation do you have?
Is it a bad situation? No, it's good.
Well, let's say I give you a test. Everyone has a test form. Right? They're spread out throughout the room. And then I collect them. I put my energy into collecting them so that I put them all in one place. That's kind of what's happening, right? If you pump protons, you're putting them all in one place. How would you describe that? What are you creating?
Storing energy.
How? In what form? What does the pumping directly accomplish?
ATP?
No.
And you need ATP to do that.
No, you don't. You need the electron transport. That's the source of energy powering the pumps. But what does the pumping accomplish? The establishment of a gradient. Well, why didn't you say it? Pumps create gradients by moving things from where they're already scarce to where they're already plentiful. It stockpiles them somewhere. Right? A gradient gets created by a pump. Low to high. High to low would be diffusion. That's passive transport. This is the opposite, which is why it requires additional energy. So the pumps create a gradient. What do I keep telling you about gradients? They're sources of energy, potential energy. So that's the answer to my original question about 10 minutes ago. When I asked, where is the energy now that the fuel is gone and now that the taxis are empty? It's in the form of a proton gradient. That's energy that used to be in glucose. It's just a transformation of energy that's occurred. First, it was part of glucose. Then it was reduced coenzymes carrying the hydrogens from the glucose or other fuels along the way. Now it's a proton gradient. So no ATP has been produced in this step, but it's worth doing this because you have a gradient now that can do some work for you. And the second part of oxidative phosphorylation is where that gradient can be put to use, phosphorylating ADP into ATP. All right? So the electron transport is the process that transforms the fuel's energy from the form of reduced coenzymes to a proton gradient. Now, something that I haven't mentioned, well, before I get to that, two things I want to talk about still on this. For electrons to be transported through the chain, of course, the chain has to accept electrons. And where is it accepting them from? Where are these electrons that are entering the chain coming from? The reduced coenzymes, NADH and FADH2. Right? Those have been created different places in previous steps. So those full taxis were the usable energy previously that was in the glucose originally. Now they're transferring that energy by delivering their passengers, electrons, to the chains. So that's the input of electrons at the upper end of the chains. Right? They get dropped off by the coenzymes. Those electrons used to be part of glucose. All right? Notice, though, that NADH drops its passengers off at complex 1, but FADH2 has to drop them off at complex 2, which is at slightly lower energy. And so the electrons that get delivered from it, FADH2, bypass this first pump. And therefore, they end up, the energy released by their electron transport only powers pumps 3 and 4. So it doesn't contribute as much to the proton gradient as electrons coming from NADH. All three of those pumps will work in the case of NADH. Do you see what I'm saying there? Is that a yes? Okay. That's why, even though FADH2 is very valuable, it's worth multiple ATPs worth of energy. It's not quite as valuable as NADH because it bypasses this first pump. And the more hydrogen ions you can pump, the more potential energy you have for the second step, which is where the ATP is actually produced. The other important thing here is that for electron transport to continue, in other words, for these pumps to continue to pump, you have to have continuous flow of electrons, not just once. And in order for the electron transport to continue, that means the last member of the chain has to get rid of its electron. It can't receive another one until it gets rid of the one it has. Right, this would be like the last person in the bucket brigade holding on to the bucket. Can't receive another bucket. So that's important for the last member of the chain to get rid of its electron, and therefore you can keep adding them at the other end and it can continue to flow through. What does that? What serves as the final electron acceptor that takes it from the chain? Oxygen. This is the reason that you have to breathe oxygen. It's the only reason you have to breathe oxygen. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor, taking the electrons from the last member of electron transport chains so that additional electrons can be added continuously. Because if they don't, if there is nothing there to take that electron from the last member of the chains will all fill up and stop running. There will be no longer any pumping of protons. Okay, does that make sense? Why is oxygen ideally suited to do this job? How would you describe that in chemical terms? That's right. Oxygen is right next door to fluorine, which is the most highly electronegative element. Oxygen has a very high electronegativity, as we've been talking about. So it gladly takes the electrons from the last member. And notice how big a jump in G it is from this last member down to oxygen is a hell of a jump in G, because oxygen is so electronegative. And so it will keep emptying the chains so that they can keep filling from the other end, and therefore keep pumping protons, and therefore maintaining a steep gradient of concentration of protons from the intermembrane space to the matrix, meaning there's a high concentration in the intermembrane space where they're being pumped to, and a low concentration in the matrix where they're being pumped from. All right, that's the potential energy, as long as that continues to happen, but that requires oxygen. All right, well, let's go to 18 now. Now we can see more of an anatomical view. You can see some membrane here, but this is not plasma membrane. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane, and it separates the intermembrane space from the mitochondrial matrix. You don't see an electron transport chain here, but you can imagine it right next door to this molecular machine that I'm just about to talk about. So you have an electron transport chain right here. Well, you have thousands of copies of them, and you have thousands of copies of this machine as well. But they're all in the inner membrane. So imagine the electrons being received by the chain from NADH and FADH2, transporting those electrons down the chain, releasing energy, which gets captured in order to cause complexes 1, 3, and 4 to pump protons from the matrix through the inner membrane to the intermembrane space. That's the gradient that's established. There's a higher concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, a lower concentration in the matrix. Therefore, there is the tendency for protons to diffuse. That's why a concentration gradient is a source of energy, because there is a tendency for protons to diffuse, just like there's a tendency for water to fall, right? And if you allow water to fall in such a way that it hits a water wheel, it will turn the wheel. That's an example of a gradient doing some work for you. So there is a tendency, because of the gradient, the proton gradient, for protons to diffuse back into the matrix through the membrane. Right? They want to do that, in other words, because of their gradient. And the easiest way, the most straightforward way, would be to simply slip through the phospholipid bilayer that makes up that membrane. But they can't do that. Why can't they do that? Well, protons are not too big. They're smaller than any atom. They're smaller than even a hydrogen atom. But they are charged. So they're plenty small, but they're fully charged. That's beyond polar, right? So they don't want to be around the hydrophobic tails of the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the inner membrane. There's still the tendency for them to want to get back in here, though. And there is a gate, a type of gate, that allows them through, which is any one of the millions of copies of this molecular machine. You just see one here. Any one of them will be a gate, though, of sorts. It'll be a way for them to get back into the matrix, diffusing. This molecular machine is called ATP synthase. And it gets that name because to synthesize means to bring together. Syn means together. ATP gets synthesized because it brings together ADP, an inorganic phosphate, to make an ATP. All right. As the name suggests, ATP synthase is an enzyme. That's why it has an ASE ending. But it's a pretty complex structure. It's much more than just a simple enzyme. It's actually multiple protein complexes to form this molecular machine. And that's not an analogy. It literally is a machine. It has moving parts. There are two major parts that have the same names as things that are make up a motor. There's a stator and a rotor. The stator is stationary. It does not move. The rotor rotates. It does move. All right, but it's all made out of proteins. The rotor, which is the part that spins, has two knobby components, one of which is embedded in the actual membrane itself. That's what keeps it in the membrane. And then it's connected via a rod to the other knobby part that's called the catalytic knob, because the catalytic knob is made out of enzymes, which are catalysts. Each one of these subunits on the catalytic knobs is really an enzyme by itself. It's just different copies of it. And so each one of these little subunits has an active site, like any enzyme would. But the active site allows ADP and inorganic phosphate to come in there and bind temporarily. And it will get those two together to form ATP, but only if that enzyme, that subunit of the catalytic knob, gets deformed in the right way. It kind of has to be squeezed in just the right way for it to actually operate as a catalyst. In other words, if no changes are being made to the catalytic knob, if it's just sitting there, it's not going to work as an enzyme. The deformation or the squeezing that is required to make this thing operate as an enzyme happens if this rotor rotates, if it spins. So what this means is that ADP and inorganic phosphate will be put together. They'll be synthesized to make ATP as long as this thing is spinning, this ATP synthase rotor. Which means, in turn, as long as you have a way to spin this thing, you're going to get a lot of ATP being made. Well, making ATP out of ADP and inorganic phosphate is an endergonic process, right? You have to put energy into doing that. The energy that you have to put into doing that is the energy that's required to spin this thing. And the source of the energy that causes this thing to spin is the diffusion of protons. So the only places in this membrane where these protons that are positively charged and therefore can't slip right through the phospholipid bilayer, the only place for them to get down their gradient back into the mitochondrial matrix via diffusion is through these rotors of ATP synthase. Each of these is a proton. And if you have a steady stream of protons, it, just like water falling on the water wheel continuously, will keep this thing spinning. The diffusion of protons. That's the payoff of the gradient, right? The gradient is powering this. The gradient is causing this to spin continuously as long as you have a gradient continuously. But you're not going to have a gradient continuously unless you continue to pump protons in the electron transport chains. Because if the chain shut down, yes, for the moment you have a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space and they will spin these and make some ATP. But without adding protons by pumping them, eventually you'll get to the point where the concentration in the matrix of protons is the same as in the intermembrane space. No more diffusion, right? No more spinning and no more ATP production. So the proton gradient is the form of energy, and it's energy that used to be in glucose, but it's now in the form of a gradient, That is actually what is directly powering the phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. And the reason this is oxidative phosphorylation is that it relies on the redox, or the oxidation, of electron transport previously. Right? Without that redox happening in electron transport, you don't have pumping. Without the gradient, which requires the pumping, you don't have this happening, which is chemiosmosis. This is the chemiosmosis part. Has nothing to do with movement of water. The osmosis part here refers to the diffusion of hydrogen ions. And this produces more than 90% of the ATP that's possible to be produced using the energy in a glucose molecule. Yeah. ATP synthase. Which, where the hell's my pens? Now, let me go on to be a better picture for what I'm going to say. In slide 19, we have basically the last two slides put together. So now you can see the membrane and the fact that it houses, or it includes, electron transport chains. This is one of them, many that are there's copies of, and ATP synthase molecules. Okay, so they're scattered throughout the inner membrane. And that's why the inner membrane folds into Christi back and forth so many times. The more inner membrane you have, the more copies of chains and ATP synthase you can have. And therefore, the more ATP that can be produced. It makes it more efficient. All right, so the chains are operating by receiving electrons from reduced coenzymes that are driving their passengers from the earlier parts, glycolysis, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and citric acid cycle. They're driving those electrons that they picked up to electron transport chains and dropping them off. Those electrons get transported from member to member of the chain. That releases a little bit of energy. Some of that energy is captured and put to use pumping protons through complexes 1, 3, and 4, taking those protons from the mitochondrial matrix, pumping them through the inner membrane into the intermembrane space. So that there is now a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, a lower concentration in the matrix. Therefore, those protons want to diffuse now back to where they got pumped from, back into the matrix. But they're only able to do that through ATP synthase molecules. And when they do that, that diffusion, which is a release of the gradient energy, powers the spinning of the rotors, which deforms the catalytic knob in just the right way to allow it to bring an ADP and an inorganic phosphate together to form ATP. All right? But importantly, it's not enough to simply deliver electrons from taxis to the chains. You also have to, at the other end of the chain, empty the chains of electrons. That's why we breathe oxygen. Notice that the oxygen is not only accepting electrons, which are half of the particles that came from the hydrogen in the fuel, they're also receiving protons. In other words, they're receiving hydrogen atoms that used to be in fuel. And when you add hydrogen atoms to oxygen, you make water. So when you think of the overall summary reaction, you start with glucose and oxygen. You end up with completely spent fuel, CO2, and water. The water that's produced includes an oxygen that used to be one that you breathed in to receive hydrogens, to receive electrons from the chains and protons in the process. Okay? And the reason I said that's so important is that if you don't have oxygen, then these chains are just going to fill up with electrons and stop working. They're not going to pump anymore. The electrons have to be transported. That's when the energy is released. If they just stay on whatever member they're with at the moment, no more pumping of protons, no more gradient, no more spinning of ATP synthase, no more production of ATP. Okay, so that's why oxygen, which is otherwise a damaging element, it does damage to you. That's why we have antioxidants. But despite that damage, it does this very important job and allows us to make energy in the form of ATP much more efficiently from the fuel we burn. Okay, now, all of this is summarized in slide 20. Slide 20 looks very similar to a slide that we started with. Go ahead.
I have one question. So, at the end, like when the oxygen cleanses,
yeah,
it release the electrons or the protons?
No, it accepts them. But what it's accepting when it accepts electrons and protons, when you get an electron and proton together, it's a hydrogen atom. So it's accepting hydrogen atoms to become water. That's called metabolic water. That's not water that you drink. That's water that you produce in your cells out of hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, so that's on the right-hand side of the summary equation. It's spit out along with CO2. Now, as I said, this is very similar to an earlier slide, which was a summary before we got into the details. Now we've been through the details, and it's still useful to look at this summary, though. So you have the overall process here, the complete oxidation of glucose, including the two parts. Glycolysis, which happens out in the cytosol, and includes 10 steps, but it has three inputs. It has a fuel input, glucose, the master fuel, which is a 6-carbon fuel. You also have to give it oxidized coenzyme in the form of NAD+. That's an input of glycolysis. And you have to give it lower energy nucleotide in the form of ADP, right? Those are the inputs. The outputs are 2 pyruvates, 2 3-carbon fuels that are still valuable but aren't as valuable as glucose originally. And you've turned the oxidized NAD+ into reduced NADH and H+, because you've stripped some hydrogen from that fuel. And a release of energy has allowed you to phosphorylate via substrate level phosphorylation the ADP into ATP. So glycolysis produces a couple of ATP per glucose molecule. But in terms of energy, it's more important that it produces 2 NADHs. That's carrying more of the energy that was in glucose than ATP is. And pyruvate is still valuable stuff. But as far as glycolysis is concerned, that it's done. Not going to do anything more with that pyruvate. The pyruvate is the starting point fuel-wise, though, for the second part of the overall process, which is cellular respiration. Right? And in the first part of cellular respiration, that pyruvate gets oxidatively decarboxylated. Meaning there's a decarboxylation, you remove a C and two O's from the pyruvate, that comes out as CO2, completely spent fuel. You have an oxidation, a redox event, so that you also produce in the process NADH and H+. More NADH is coming out of this first part. This the white arrow here is the oxidative decarboxylation of glucose of pyruvate, and that will leave as fuel a 2-carbon compound, the acetyl group, still valuable, just not as valuable as pyruvate. And that gets picked up by an empty taxi called coenzyme A. So the full taxi is called acetyl coenzyme A. Coenzyme A drives that to carbon fuel, the acetyl, to the citric acid cycle, which is part two of cellular respiration. The citric acid cycle completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton and the dehydrogenation of the fuel. So instead of having a six carbon fuel like you did with glucose that has plenty of hydrogens on it, you now have six individual particles that have just one carbon in them and no hydrogen. That's carbon dioxide. Worthless as far as energy is to the cell, as is concerned to the cell. But in that process, the citric acid cycle, you also produce some more ATP via substrate level phosphorylation. And even more importantly, in terms of energy, you produce more reduced coenzymes in the form of NADH and H+ and FADH2. So now you have some ATP that has been produced, some energy that's lost as heat, and a lot of energy that used to be in the fuel but now is in the form of full taxis, reduced coenzymes. Doesn't matter where they picked them up, glycolysis, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, or citric acid cycle, they're all these taxis are carrying electrons and protons that are going to be dropped off at the same place, which is electron transport chains that are part of oxidative phosphorylation, part three of cellular respiration. And that drop-off of electrons is going to reoxidize all these coenzymes, right? It's going to turn the NADH back into NAD+. It's going to turn FADH2 back into FAD. That's important because a taxi can't pick up more than one passenger. To reoxidize the coenzymes means that they can go back and pick up more electrons earlier in the process. Dropping them off, though, the electrons, means that those electrons can be transported through the chains, releasing energy that can be used to pump protons, establishing a proton gradient across the inner mitochondrial membrane, which makes for a tendency of those hydrogen ions or protons to diffuse back into the matrix. The only way they're allowed to do that is through ATP synthase molecules. And that diffusion of protons through ATP synthase causes the spinning of the rotors and therefore the oxidative phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. That's the big payoff because more than 90% of the ATP that's produced in this overall process is produced in this final step. Now, the electrons that trickle down through the electron transport chains end up being hydrogens, electrons and protons, end up being hydrogens accepted by oxygen that you breathe to produce water. Any questions about that overall summary? Okay, then let's talk more about oxygen. There's only one place in this whole process, in fact in your whole body really, that oxygen's required for. That is to serve as the final electron acceptor at the end of electron transport chains. Okay? In other words, oxygen is not required directly for glycolysis. It's not required for the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. It's not required for the citric acid cycle. Nevertheless, if you don't have oxygen, all of those other things would shut down. Because if you don't have something serving as the final electron acceptor, that means the last member of each chain won't be able to pass the electrons on. So the next to last members of the chain won't be able to pass them to the last members. The whole chain, each chain will fill up with electrons, right? That means no more pumping of protons and therefore no more chemiosmosis to produce more ATP. That's one problem. That's actually stopping things downstream of oxygen. But also, there's the secondary problem. If all the electrons fill up, all the electron transport chains fill up, that means they can't accept any more electrons from coenzymes, from the taxis, right? You have a certain number of taxis in the fleet. Any one at any given moment is either oxidized or reduced, right? There are full taxis, empty taxis, but there's a finite number of taxis. If you didn't have any oxygen taking off the electrons from the chains and all the chains filled up, then none of these taxis that are carrying passengers would be able to drop them off anymore. So eventually, all the taxis would be full. They would all be reduced. Right? And if you don't have any oxidized or empty taxis, oxidized coenzymes, which are empty taxis, then you don't have any available that are required for these earlier processes. A little while ago, I told you there are three inputs to glycolysis. Glucose, the fuel, ADP, and NAD+, oxidized coenzyme. You have to have empty taxis. If you don't, glycolysis stops. So, yes, oxygen is not directly required for glycolysis, but it would stop everything, all the way back to glycolysis even. Because glycolysis requires oxidized coenzymes to operate. Cellular respiration, when it does work, because oxygen is available, is beneficial, of course, because of the production of ATP, but it's also beneficial for the side benefit of reoxidizing coenzymes, emptying the taxis, in other words, so that they can go drive back to these earlier processes and pick up more, allowing these things to continue. Glycolysis would shut down. I say would shut down, but it doesn't in the absence of oxygen. And that's because cells have an alternative way of reoxidizing NADH back into NAD+. We see that in slide 21. What we see here are a couple different versions of a process that's called fermentation. Now, fermentation is an anaerobic process, meaning that it occurs in the absence of oxygen. This is not anaerobic respiration. Don't let anyone tell you that it is, because I've seen people make this mistake who should know better. Fermentation is anaerobic, but it is not anaerobic respiration. We can't do anaerobic respiration. Only certain species can do that. All respiration, whether it's aerobic respiration, which is what we do involving oxygen, or anaerobic respiration, what makes it respiration is the operation of electron transport chains pumping protons. Okay? That's what respiration is. There's two major categories of respiration. Aerobic, in which the final electron acceptor is oxygen, because you have to have a final electron acceptor or you no longer have respiration, because everything shuts down. Or anaerobic respiration, which is basically the same as what we've been studying, except some organisms use something other than oxygen to take that electron off the chain. Okay, that's respiration still, and produces a lot of ATP, just like aerobic respiration does. It just uses something other than oxygen. That's not what we have here. What we have here is not respiration. This is fermentation. But it's occurring in the absence of oxygen, therefore it's anaerobic. And what we have here is really just an alternative way to empty the taxis. Glycolysis has to be allowed to continue, or the cell dies. If you have oxygen and cellular respiration is working, that cellular respiration process empties the taxis because they have somewhere to dump their electrons onto, right? And therefore, those now re-emptied or reoxidized NAD pluses can drive back to glycolysis and pick up more hydrogen and allow glycolysis to happen. But if you don't have oxygen and cellular respiration shuts down and all your taxis become full, you need some other way to empty those taxis so that glycolysis can continue. That's what fermentation is, an alternative way to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. And there are many different versions of fermentation that have evolved in different species. Any given species is only going to conduct one kind of fermentation. Yeah?
Can you repeat yourself? Is the fermentation of an alternative way?
It's an alternative way to reoxidize NADH into NAD+, which is another way of saying to empty the taxi. Because glycolysis needs empty taxis. Glycolysis fills the taxis, so it requires empty taxis to fill. And if all the taxis are full, then glycolysis will shut down and the organism will die. So there's different ways that this has evolved, but any given species will do one version or the other. Even though there's many forms of fermentation, almost all textbooks just mention two. And mainly that's because there's two that humans in general are especially interested in. One is called alcohol fermentation because it produces ethanol, the alcohol that's in all alcoholic beverages. And that's why we're interested in that one, because we, not only because we produce alcohol for drinking, but alcohol's useful for a lot of reasons. And the other one that most textbooks mention is lactic acid fermentation. And the reason that one's usually mentioned is because that's the one that our own cells are able to do. But there's plenty of other versions as well in nature. Even though the particulars are different, the point is that all fermentation methods accomplish the same thing, meaning they all reoxidize NADH back into NAD+. That means it turns a full taxi into an empty taxi, so that that empty taxi can go back to glycolysis and pick up more electrons and protons, and glycolysis can therefore continue to happen. If you have cellular respiration happening, you don't need fermentation because cellular respiration is emptying those taxis. Right? But if cellular respiration is not happening, you have to prevent glycolysis from stopping, and you do that with an alternative way of emptying the taxis. That's fermentation. Alcohol fermentation, by the way, is it takes the pyruvate that glycolysis spits out and it decarboxylates it, so it produces CO2, producing an intermediate called acetaldehyde, which is then converted into ethanol in the redox process that actually accomplishes the reoxidation. So it's not that the cell is really trying to make alcohol, which when it builds up is going to poison the cell. What it's doing it because it's the only way it has of emptying the taxi so that glycolysis can continue. Our own cells don't do that. Otherwise, we could just hold our breath and get drunk, right? Instead, we take our pyruvate and directly turn it into lactate without producing CO2. Lactate or lactic acid is what will build up if you are very strenuously exercising. If you sprint, you're exercising so vigorously that your heart and lungs cannot keep up with the demand for oxygen. So eventually your cell's going to start going to fermentation instead. That's going to build up lactic acid, which is part of fatigue. That's why your body will not let you do that after a certain point. You'll just collapse if you keep trying to sprint. On the other hand, if you jog, you know, if you jog while you eat, you could do it indefinitely, really, because you're keeping up with the oxygen demand. So that's the big deal about fermentation. Fermentation by itself doesn't really produce any ATP. I mean, the ATP is produced by glycolysis, but fermentation doesn't add anything. You still have 2 ATP per glucose. It's just that you'd have 0 without lactic acid in the absence of oxygen. Okay, 22 shows you that the cell really has a choice after glycolysis. Or I shouldn't say after glycolysis. What glycolysis is going to happen either way. whether there's oxygen or not. But if there is oxygen, then it makes sense for a cell, if it's capable of cellular respiration, and not all species are, but if it has a mitochondrion, it makes sense to take the pyruvate that glycolysis spits out and use it efficiently to make a hell of a lot more ATP, right? That's why it makes sense to make the more ATP, but it also has the side benefit of reoxidizing the NAD back into NAD plus so that you can continue the glycolysis. On the other hand, if there is no O2, that will shut down aerobic respiration, but it won't shut down glycolysis because the cell can switch to fermentation to make its empty taxis, or to make its taxis empty again. And it just happens automatically. It's not that it's really making a decision. Cellular respiration will happen automatically because oxygen being there will empty those electron transport chains, which will then accept electrons automatically from the NADHs and FADH2s. So this overall process that we keep talking about in this chapter is illustrated by these four rectangles, glycolysis and cellular respiration below it. That's the so-called central metabolic pathway. And we've been talking about fuel as, I mean, we've been talking about this from the viewpoint of using glucose as a fuel, which is the most used fuel. It's the master fuel in all cells, all organisms. So it's excellent fuel, but it's not the only possible fuel. There are three major nutrient classes, meaning nutrients that come from food, proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. They all can provide fuel, which can exploit this central pathway, even though it's not necessarily glucose that you're starting with as the fuel. So carbohydrates, well, that includes polysaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, all those, right? First of all, you can't use a polysaccharide as a fuel. You have to break it down into monosaccharides, which is what the book means by sugars. That means specifically monosaccharides. Those can be used as fuel. When you do break down polysaccharides, a lot of those monomers, those monosaccharides, are glucose. So that can just go through the process as we described it. But there's also other monosaccharides, right, that polysaccharides can be built of, like fructose and so on. Well, those other kinds of monosaccharides are actually intermediates in this process, if you look at the details of them. So they can just skip the glycolysis starting point and go into a later stage. And then everything else is the same. And that's how they're used as fuels. If you have fats, well, those are macromolecules as well, so they're not fuels. They have to be broken down to produce fuels. The fuels are the glycerol and the fatty acids that you break them down into, right? Those are the building blocks they're made out of. Well, glycerol can feed right into glycolysis at a later step. And fatty acids, which, recall, a fatty acid is a long chain of carbons and hydrogens. Fatty acids are processed to make fuel by stripping the fatty acid chain, the long chain, stripping it of two carbons at a time and the hydrogens. In other words, acetyl groups are taken off of the fatty acids. Just like the two carbon fuel that's left after pyruvate is decarboxylated, that's acetyl. You can get the same thing from a fatty acid picked up by coenzyme A to make acetyl coenzyme A. So it continues as though it started out as glucose, even though it didn't. Those are the two major ways we store energy in our body, carbohydrates and fats. Proteins can also, though, be used as a fuel source. The proteins themselves aren't fuel, they have to be broken down into the things that they're made out of, which are amino acids. Now, we don't usually do this. Proteins can be used as fuel, but they really aren't supposed to be used as fuel all that often. They're usually structures. So there's a lot of recycling of proteins in the body, and that's why you don't need nearly as much proteins as Americans have been led to believe. And in fact, an overabundance of proteins causes cancer, it's looking like. But you can use them as fuels if you're out of the others. So if you fast, for instance, intentionally fast or unintentionally, you'll have stores of energy in your body, glycogen, which is carbohydrate, and fats that have been delivered to parts of your bodies earlier. Well, those will be used first. And when you're out of those stores, then you start breaking down the proteins of your body, including your muscles. That's what we say when we're wasting away. If you still haven't eaten, then you'll be using your proteins. Well, you break them down into amino acids, and the amino acids have the hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen that these other fuels do, but they also have nitrogen in them, which is problematic. The nitrogen has to be removed, and it's removed as ammonia, which is toxic, NH3. The liver then deals with that by converting the ammonia into urea, which is also toxic, but not as toxic. And your kidneys then get rid of the urea as part of your urine. That's nitrogenous waste. But the rest of it, the carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen from those amino acids, can be put into different parts of this central pathway and used as fuel. The final slide, 24, also shows this central pathway. But here it shows you feedback that can control how fast this pathway is running. You don't always want to be running this complete oxidation of glucose or this central pathway at full bore all the time. That would be a total waste of energy. Right? Your energy demands change depending on what you're doing. So notice that there are control points. The enzymes are important. You know, there's many enzymes involved. Every individual step has its own enzyme. And those are each individually important as a catalyst, of course. But there are some enzymes that are particularly important control points. As I said in an earlier lecture, enzymes can be controlled, switching them on or off, and therefore you can control the entire pathway by turning those enzymes on or off. So phosphofructokinase, for instance, is an important enzyme in glycolysis that if you control it, you can control how fast this rest of this stuff happens. The red arrows are inhibitory feedback, and the green is stimulatory. Notice that ATP, being produced by all of this stuff, can itself serve as a signal. If you're running this process faster than you need to, making more ATP than you need at the moment, that's an error. That's telling your body you don't really need to do this. Right? So the ATP itself, when it starts really building up, can inhibit phosphofructokinase and turn off further production of ATP until you start using what you already have. Similarly, citrate, when it builds up from the citric acid cycle, it tells you that the citrate is not going through the cycle anymore. So it's the cycle can't run any more than it already is, and therefore it will inhibit it. AMP, on the other hand, stimulates it, ramps up production, which should also make sense to you, right? Because AMP, if it's there in abundance, the reason it is in abundance is because you've already dephosphorylated your ATP and your ADP. You've gotten rid of almost all the energy you have in nucleotide form. And that should tell the cell, you need to deal with this quickly. Put phosphates back onto the AMP to turn them back into ATP. And therefore, you need to run this central pathway a lot faster than you have been. So it stimulates metabolism. And that is the chapter. So we have one more chapter in the unit, which is photosynthesis. I'll have plenty of time to cover that. So we're just on schedule, and that's perfect timing to stop. So enjoy your break.